Hey there everyone, and welcome to the Manacast, conversations about a vision of life that is truly good news for us, for our neighbours, and for the world. My name's Jacob Garrett, and with me is Jonathan Cornford.
G'day folks.
Manacast is Managum's podcast. Managum is all about the intersection of Christian faith with ecology and economics. We're doing a little history and interpreting history series here. This is part two. If you want to get to part one, where we talk about Constantine, his life and times, that's probably really good background for this episode, because we're going to be discussing some of the different ways what happened then and what happened since then in Christian history has been interpreted by different scholars, the impacts, good or bad. But before we dive in, we want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands we work on and we're recording from. I'm talking to you today, as usual, from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation from the city of Melbourne.
And I, still on the same day from when we did our last episode, I'm talking to you from the lands of the Jajawarang people.
It's still hot.
It's getting hotter.
And we'd like to acknowledge these peoples as the traditional custodians of these lands. We pay our respects to their elders past and present. So, in that last episode, we talked all about Constantine and a little bit about the complexities of understanding him, what actually happened in the history of his life, as well as his impact on Christianity and Christianity in the Roman world in particular. Now we're going to be diving headfirst into some prominent scholars who have had very different views on what it all means, all the way up to different conceptions of how the ultimate meaning of the Christian gospel and the right way of being Christian in the world ought to be conceived, understood, and practiced. Isn't that right, John?
Yep.
It's pretty big stuff.
Yes, yes. That's right. But before we go there, I think it's just I've just realized a couple of things we didn't make clear in the previous episode. And one is just to firstly clarify one misconception that a lot of people think that when Constantine became the first Christian emperor, then Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire. That wasn't the case. So what actually happened under Constantine was that he legalized Christianity, made it from being a repressed and persecuted sect to being legal. And he also then began to show it some favor personally as an emperor, so making gifts to churches and to bishops and things like that. But it had no separate legal standing within the empire. That was something that happened by stages, and it wasn't really complete, didn't really take shape until the late in the 4th century with Theodosius, and when he makes Christianity the official religion somewhere in the 380s or 390s, he also, as well as making Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, begins to, in a couple of stages to effectively make paganism illegal. After that.
Yeah. And it even then, like in stages, that sort of things that are associated with paganism continue for some time. There's classical education in the Eastern Roman Empire all the way up to, I think, Justinian or even, yeah, somewhere around there in the 6th century. So these things definitely happened by stages. It wasn't this clear cut and dry Constantine comes in, New World Order sort of thing.
Sure. And so when we're talking about the Constantinian shift, which is, I guess, sort of the core idea of these podcasts, actually what we're talking about is not just Constantine himself and what he did, but actually pretty much the century following him as well, and then what came thereafter as well.
Mm. Yeah.
And another one thing to just make clear, which we mentioned, I think, that Constantine he convened the Council of Nicaea, which was one of the great ecumenical councils of the church, the first great ecumenical council of the church, where basically for the first time he hosted and convened all the bishops of the empire to get together and to hash out some of the doctrinal disputes they'd been having. And that was the beginning of when we really start to have an official version of orthodoxy. And Christianity becomes less diverse, and they begin to put more structure around the church. Now there are various contested views about what that meant and what that looked like, but that's the broad outline of that is also significant for what we're about to say.
Hmm. Yeah, and lots of people contest these things. Basically, John's done a bunch of reading of a bunch of them, and he's going to give us a little bit of an outline. We're going to play with the ideas drawn up by different scholars and different perspectives and sort of tease them out a little bit. You might find that as you're listening, you've got sympathy to a particular perspective or a particular way of seeing things. And so it'll be just interesting to see, well, what issues does that leave you with, or what does it someone else say into that?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to have a go at taking us through six different authors. And if you could sort of imagine two columns in your mind, you could roughly put them in scholars who are critical of the Constantinian shift and scholars who are sympathetic to it. That's more true for some of those authors than others. Some of them are a bit more complex and nuanced than two columns. But, you know, at least to start with, just bear with me. That's a sort of a nice, easy way to begin thinking about it. So, yeah, I'm going to have a go at taking you through six of them. And hopefully Jacob will interrupt me along the way if I get too long-winded. And, yeah, I'm going to try and stick close to my notes here so I don't go off to script, because there's so much to say in all of these things. And it'll just give you a flavor of each of them, and then I guess we'll just see where it goes, hey?
Yeah, sounds good. So our first one is John Howard Yoder. He's pretty critical of the Constantinian shift, is that right?
He is. So John Howard Yoder, dead now, famous, probably the most famous Anabaptist theologian of the 20th century, had a big impact on theology generally. And he's famous for really coining a term called Constantinianism. So sort of an ideology, which I'll come to in a moment. So here I'm talking about a few things he's written. One of them is an essay. He wrote lots on this, by the way. And so I'm just going to draw on one essay in particular called The Constantinian Sources of Social Ethics. And so he's really looking at how the Constantinian shift changed particularly Christian ethics completely.
So that stuff about violence and wealth we were talking about last episode.
Yeah, and that is for particularly for Yoder. He was a prominent pacifist, so it's the question around violence, and the Anabaptists generally are pacifists, so that is a key issue for them. But also relationship to power and wealth is up there as well. And so they will be, I guess, real themes throughout this podcast is what happens around power, violence, and wealth in Christianity. So just to try and summarize, Yoder, you get a nice indication of his position when he points out that before Constantine, it took some conviction to be a Christian, but after Constantine, it took some conviction not to be a Christian, which not very neatly outlines a pretty major shift. The truth of the matter, it was a bit later; it was pretty much after Theodosius, but you get that the bigger concept holds well, that before the Constantinian shift, to be a Christian was a big thing. You had to count the cost and make a decision because it could be very costly for you up to your life. Afterwards, you had to count the cost after Theodosius, and particularly in medieval Europe, if you decided you either wanted to not be a Christian, which was almost unthinkable, or if you wanted to be a different kind of Christian from what was defined as orthodoxy.
Yeah, huge shift there.
Another thing that Yoder says that neatly captures a shift is he points out that before Constantine, the community of believers, that the fact that there was such a thing as a believing community was an empirical fact, and God's rule of history was actually a matter of faith. So the existence of a believing community was an empirical fact, but trusting in God's rule of history was a matter of faith, and that was something that would come be fully disclosed at the end of history with the second coming of Christ.
Yeah, if you're being dispossessed of your property or being imprisoned, you've got to believe that the God you worship is actually the one in control.
Exactly. Whereas after the Constantinian shift, God's rule of history seems to have become an empirical fact. God has acted in history and instituted a Christian order, but the existence of a believing community becomes a matter of faith. So what happens when you say everyone's a Christian in society, and but actually you just look around and you know everyone's not really a Christian? So you've got to say, well, actually, there's something called, you have to come up with something called the true church. There's the real church, the one we see, and then there's this thing called the true church that we take as a matter of faith. So that also nicely captures a big shift.
Big issue for the reformers, right? Like, who's the actual Christians? Where is the church really? Because it's sort of everywhere. There's a church building on every corner, but you know, are the people in there really Christian? You wouldn't have that problem before the Constantinian shift.
And that will be one of our key questions. Where is the church? Another thing Yoda points out, he says that he's big on this. He says from Constantine onwards, and this continues, he would take this right up until our present day, the state becomes the main bearer of historical movement. Now, what he's meaning by that is when we think about history as either, you know, moving forward, getting better, or history going backwards, getting worse, what are we actually talking about? And Yoda argues that from the time of Constantine onwards, we're mostly talking about states and what they're doing, whether that's good or bad. They are the bearer of ethics, human ethics in history, and whether we're improving or getting worse, which is different from the whole concept of the New Testament, where the one who changes in everything, the one who is the bearer of history, Christ, is the one who renounces power. So the Messiah, Christ's messiahship is defined in the temptations by what he says no to. And so Yoda makes a lot of that. And so along with that, all these changes, particularly with the church, Yoda also is big on emphasizing that the conception of ethics within Christian society changed from that of a distinctive lifestyle, a visibly distinctive lifestyle, towards really focusing your actions to supporting what was now considered right, and what was right was the existence of a Christian order. So your ethics is directed towards continuing the existence of that Christian order. You do what you need to do to make sure that continues, rather than yourself behaving in a visibly distinctive way.
Yeah, so instead of not being allowed to be a soldier, you join the army and make sure the Roman world survives, something like that.
Yeah, be a good Christian by fighting for Rome.
Yeah, yeah.
Along with that, so associated with that, Yoda argues that moral reasoning then for Christians switches to becoming utilitarianism. That is, how do you judge whether something's good or bad or not, or the right thing to do or not? You make a decision by whether it works or not towards, and that's because you've got a given goal in mind. Your goal in mind is to either institute a Christian order or to protect a Christian order. And therefore, is this right or not? Does it further that goal? Rather than, do I do what's right or wrong, irrespective of whether it's going to work or not? He says, and so basically, if moral reasoning becomes dominated by the question of effectiveness, and rather than faithfulness.
Yeah. So basically, if this works to extend the Roman rule, say the Christian Roman rule of the world, then it's a good thing to do.
Yeah. Yep. That's his. And he argues that we can still continue with that sort of moral reasoning in all sorts of subtle ways, right down to the present day. And you know, so what Yoda's arguing then, really essentially that this is what he calls Constantinianism, thinking in these ways, thinking about ethics and thinking about the direction of history through these lenses. And he says we're all, since the Constantinian shift, if we're in the modern West, we're all inheritors of it. It was, so even though we had the Reformation, although the Reformation made a break with the Catholic Church and with the Pope, it didn't make a break with Constantinian thinking. In fact, it reinstituted in its own forms in their various nations. Then it became, in a lot of ways, became sharper. Not only, at least, he says, you know, at least with the Roman Empire, Christianity was associating itself with a universal idea, the idea of empire governing everyone. After the Reformation, it associated itself with nation states and different Christian nation states, each had official churches, and they fought each other, which he said, you know, makes it even worse again by some measures.
Claiming to be the true church, of course.
Yeah, and he argues in different ways that we associate ethics and the direction of history with power, right through to the even into secularized revolutionary politics in the 20th century. So communist ethics is based on he's arguing on the same basic assumptions. So that's my very inadequate go at trying to summarize some of what Yoda has to say.
Yeah, and I've got a lot of sympathy for a lot of those critiques. Like, I think that's often the position I'm taking to push someone else on things. But I guess to push back on Yoda, I find it hard to conceptualize what the real alternative is if you have emperors, or even just like the Roman elite, the aristocracy, the people who are governors and things below the emperor, even if those people are becoming Christians, or wider society is getting quite a decent proportion of people who are quote unquote real Christians, however people we're defining that, people who are taking it seriously, what's the alternative for how society functions or changes? Like, what's the way he thinks it should have gone?
Yeah, really good question. So he doesn't really go through thinking through historical alternatives. He does at one point hypothetically ask, you know, could you have been had a? So he's saying that Constantine essentially, in his strongest terms, he calls the Constantinian shift a fall, just like Adam and Eve was a fall. So that's pretty big language, and he also calls it an apostasy. So that's a rejection of Christian, true Christian faith. So he's pretty...
That's no uncertain terms.
No, he's pretty black and white about it. At one point, he does say, though, what if you did have a Christian who just ended up becoming emperor? Would that work? And he says, well, that you might conceive of that as something that could happen in history, but if they are to remain a faithful Christian, they're probably not going to stay emperor for very long before someone else gets them, is basically his view.
But I guess that's maybe imagining that there are other people in the sort of wings wanting to be emperor who aren't Christian. But if there's a decent proportion of the ruling elite are Christian, like, how does it work? How does the state function like that?
Look, it's a good question. So I think his basic assumption is that basically the followers of Christ in the world are always going to be people who are faithful to the way of Christ, and that's the faith, what he called the faithful and the believing community, are always going to be a minority in a fallen world.
Right.
So his view of history is that everyone being faithful to God doesn't come about to the end of history. So we should stop looking for that here and now. We should stop trying to make it come about by... And he says, look, even... I'm kind of trying to imagine arguing for him now. Mm. These are not his words, but imagine what he would say would be something like this. Look, there's no point playing hypotheticals. What is important for those who are wanting to follow Christ is simply to try and be faithful to Christ in the moment that they find themselves and see what happens. So he's arguing that's what didn't happen with the Constantinian shift. So he's part of what a inheritor of the Radical Reformation, so the whole Anabaptist movement, where they're saying actually what we're trying to recapture is faithfulness to Christ above all. And if that means we're an oppressed minority again, so be it.
Mm. Does that mean that it's at least theoretically possible? Like, if it's about faithfulness in the moment, is it institutional church, some sort of partnership between state power and church is inherently by definition unacceptable? Or is it just like, well, we'll see. We'll go with you as far as we can go with you, and then we'll depart from you and take the consequences.
Yes, I think he would certainly say the church should not have any real world. The church should not have any real world political power. He would certainly say that, and he mostly wants to say that Christians they can be involved with power up to an extent. The point is which, for him, the ethical point is at which point you're going to end up inflicting coercive violence on another person. That's his red line.
Mm.
So, for example, he imagines you could have Christian parliamentarians acting faithfully, representing a voice in parliament, but he finds it hard to think you could stay a successful politician long and be in cabinet government, for example, and be a faithful Christian. That's his red line. So I think.
Yeah, fascinating. We probably should move on. Our next person's quite different to Yoda, Oliver O'Donovan. Tell us about him.
Okay, so Oliver O'Donovan is a English, and I guess you'd call him an evangelical Anglican theologian, and he's and I'm particularly working off a book he's very well known for called The Desire of the Nations, and it's his a pretty big, important work of political theology. And in some ways, he's reacting to Yoda. Yoda's one of his reaction points in what he's writing. And what O'Donovan wants to reclaim, essentially, is where he sees basically Yoda undermining any potential for Christians really to have a good theory of political power, other than we don't want it. He's trying to rebuild a political theology of political authority, a basis by which we can think about and also affirm the role of political authority from a Christian perspective.
And he's pretty like vague on the whole Constantinian question, right? He doesn't really get into it in those terms.
So he hardly. It's interesting. His book is come to be known as a defense of Christendom, and he sort of does provide a defense of Christendom, which is the outcome of the Constantinian shift. But he hardly talks about Constantine at all, and doesn't really talk much about the Constantinian shift. So he's not, and in some ways, that's one of his reactions to Yoda is just to sort of ignore those things. But what he argues is what he's really trying to argue for is how Christian thinkers developed the concept of the role of political authority in relation to the church. So one of the things he says is that Christendom, that's Christianity eventually becoming the favored and official religion, was something that we should think about it as the outcome of the church's mission in society. It's something that happened. And he says, you know, if the church is really engaging in its mission in societies as it's meant to, and if Christ really is defeats the powers and the principalities, we shouldn't be surprised that at some point in time, some ruler is going to bow the knee to Christ. He's not arguing that it had to happen as an outcome of history, that it's something ordained, but he's saying that it did happen, and we should think about it, and we should think about what happened out of that experience. And he very much wants to argue for the positives that came out of this this marriage, if you like, from Christendom.
Mm.
So let me read you a quote here. He says, with the vast change of context catalyzed by the Edict of Milan, and that was the edict after Constantine won his battle at Milvian Bridge we mentioned last episode, where they basically legalized Christianity. After the vast change of context catalyzed by the Edict of Milan, the question of how to understand the obedience of rulers came high in the church's agenda. There is no point in regretting this. The church of that age had to do contextual theology just as we do.
So it's just the situation you find yourself in.
Yep. Just deal with it. You've got to deal with it, which means you've got to come up with theories of rule and theories of power, which is what theologians and church leaders did throughout the history of Christendom. So you have this ongoing dialogue between church and rulers, and it's a very mixed dialogue. But he says a lot of good came out of it.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, a lot of bad came out of it too, right?
Sure. Look, and maybe this is O'Donovan's weakness, and I've often wondered about this, but I suspect it's part of his reaction to Yoda, is that he sort of ignores all the, he doesn't mention or hardly mentions all the bad stuff that happened during Christendom, all the hypocrisy, all the terrible stuff done in the name of Christ. And instead he really focuses on what he calls the idea of Christendom. He's much more interested in the ideas that come out of it rather than the actual practice of this bishop or that pope or this Christian king or so on.
Mm.
And it's those developing ideas that he sees as the real gift of Christendom to humanity. And it's really from those ideas he basically sees our, essentially the modern Western liberal order and democracy coming out of. So right at the heart of his idea of what's happening in Christendom, and going right back to the early days of Constantine and his immediate successors, is that what's happening, even if it's not necessarily happening at the human level, what's certainly happening at the rhetorical and political level is that Christ is being placed above rulers unequivocally. So if you say you're a Christian ruler, that means you are saying that you must be subservient to Christ. And once you do that as an emperor or a king, then even if you really don't take that seriously, you are constrained in what you can do. And he's basically arguing that both in the theology of the New Testament, but also in the actuality of what unfolds in history, is that Christ's triumph pushes back the power of political rulers from being able to do whatever they like, at least, and justify it.
Mm.
And under the developing ideas of Christendom, political rule is given a very specific vocation, and it's to ensure peace and it's to bring about the just judgments in society. So that's his idea of the authentic idea of Christendom, even if it wasn't very often the actual practice of it.
Yeah, I sort of wonder about the authenticity question, because if you've got bishops or even the Pope on your side, they're a pretty good mouthpiece for what counts as authentic in the eyes of most people. And if you can sort of, maybe they're already inclined this way, or you can persuade them to go with you on it, you can kind of shift the conversation about what authentic means with these powerful Christian voices on your side. And then you can kind of have a slippage, I suppose, through society of, well, now this is what it means to be authentic. Well, now from there, this is what it means to be authentic. And you kind of, how do you actually hold that in check?
Sure. And look, I think to argue for, like to try and take on what O'Donovan would respond, he'd say, yep, absolutely. It's complex. There's lots of people saying different things. But what you actually have happening sort of through this dialogue back and forth over centuries and centuries is essentially a growing clarification of some things which he calls are the fruit of Christendom. And essentially those things are the idea of responsible government, the basic ideas of freedom of speech that we now have, and of freedom of conscience. These things, even though a lot of people say, well, what about the Spanish Inquisition and so on? Exactly. Of course, he's saying that it wasn't straightforward. But through the ongoing back and forth over centuries of Christian ideas with the question of what it means to rule, you end up with, by the time of by the modern era, the ideas of responsible government that we take for granted. We think that they're secular ideas, or maybe they are born in the Enlightenment. And in this, I think he makes a pretty strong case that actually the core ideas are born really out of Christianity and the Christian thinking. As much as you may point to the hypocrisy, and I think one of his weaknesses is that he didn't do that, and he would have had a stronger argument if he dealt with that stuff. But he would say, you know, but this is the fruit, the complex work of the Holy Spirit through history, is what he would ask, argue.
Mm. Yeah, fascinating. On the side of someone who's pretty keen to not emphasize the hypocrisy and push the prose of Constantine, we have Peter Leithart. Tell us about him.
Okay, so Peter Leithart is an American Reformed theologian. I guess he would describe himself as a conservative theologian. And he wrote a book called Defending Constantine.
So it's right there in the title.
Pretty clear where he stands. And he's actually quite, of all the thinkers I'm outlining, he's the one I disagree with most, so I'll just put that up front. But actually, he does ask good questions. I do think he sees a lot of things clearly, and the questions he asks are often good ones, even if the answers he comes to are different from the answers I might like to come to. But so he's really pushing the prose of Constantine himself, the man and the changes that he instituted. So he definitely is arguing, makes an argument for a sincere Christian conversion for Constantine. And so I guess there's some points where his argument is, susceptible to questions of historical, did that actually happen or not? Because he is depending on some versions of history rather than, so he's making a particular case around that. I think he asks good questions, and one of them he says is the question is not whether or not there was a shift. The question, he means in Christianity, the question is which changes fulfilled the gospel and which changes betrayed it.
Right. So he's really broadening the conversation there.
Yeah, and I think he's spot on. That is the right question. If you're for a Christian person looking at this, that's our presupposition, by the way. So his answer is he thinks Constantine was fulfilling the gospel by bringing Christians to rule. So he sees it as the trajectory of the gospel for Christians to rule the world, just as Islamists would see the trajectory of Islam is to see Islam ruling the world, whether you're a Muslim or not.
So he's pretty much the opposite of Yoda. Yoda thinks that you know the Christians have got it wrong when they think faithfulness is ruling the world. And Peter Leithart says, you know you're faithful when Christians are ruling the world.
Yes, and he knows it. So he's explicit about his and he actually is explicitly disagreeing with Yoda all the way through his book. So what he's arguing, he doesn't see things through rose-colored windows. He knows there was hypocrisy. He knows Constantine had blood on his hands, although maybe he avers the extent of that a little bit, maybe. But he knows that, you know, and he's not arguing that it was in any way perfect or the perfect order was instituted. But what he's saying was arguing is a big shift came about in history, that we still live in the positive benefits of it. He says effectively that Constantine baptized the Roman Empire. And he says, but it was an infant baptism. So, you know, and a child, an infant baptism, they're baptized before they really know what's going on. And then they've sort of got to grow up into the faith. And he argues that that's basically what happens with Christendom. And he baptized the Roman aristocracy. He ended sacrificial religion and these things. So, and that for these things, we should thank Constantine. So, and he does push that question we asked in the previous podcast. He says, Christian criticizing Constantine demands an effort to imagine historically plausible alternatives. Because, you know, no one knew what it meant. And no one at that time knew what it meant for an emperor to be a Christian or a Christian to be an emperor. And he asks, you know, after the Diocletian persecution, how was the church to react once, you know, someone says, well, we're going to stop the persecution?
Yeah, but I mean, at this, like, I take what he's saying, and I think there was some sort of baptism, if you can call it that, of the Roman Empire. Like things did shift, but I do wonder about what else do you expect? We might expect there would be more change within what a ruler looks like if they're a Christian than we actually saw, right?
Yeah. Yep. You could argue that. He's happy for things to be mixed and just for the fact of Christian rule itself and its direction to be seen as the important thing.
He doesn't have as much issue with the mutual rubbing off. Romanization of Christianity, Christianization of Romania.
No, he doesn't have as much of a problem about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's curious. Someone who's responding directly to Leithart, I think, is Alan Kreider. He takes issue with that idea, or at least he flips the script on the baptized idea. He says, really, the baptism was the other direction more than the Roman Empire was baptized, but the Christianity of the time was baptized into Romanness.
That's right. So Alan Kreider is also an Anabaptist. He's a Mennonite church historian, and he was for 20 years a missionary as well. So he wrote quite a lot about the early church, particularly before the Constantinian shift. But here I'm particularly drawing off a essay he wrote in response to Peter Leithart's book, Defending Constantine, taking on Leithart's arguments directly. And a lot of his arguments have to do with some things we mentioned last week around the whole question of baptism. So Kreider particularly wants to argue that there was a huge shift in not just the outward form of Christianity, but the content of Christianity and what it was about, and that it affected everything from Christian ethics to how Christians thought about worship, how they thought about evangelism, what is the good news that we're inviting people into, and how they understood the Christian community. And so one of the things he takes on for making his argument was how big the shift was within Christianity around attitudes to violence. So I think I mentioned already in the previous episode, in the second and third century, we have a whole, there's a bunch of Christian documents that show pretty strong attitudes within the early church to violence. We don't think it's universal. There was diversity, but there's enough that when you look across all the different documents that make up early Christianity to describe what Kreider calls an ecosystem of peace within Christianity. So it's not just what they say explicitly about violence, whether you can be a soldier or not, but it's actually about the whole way they think about and talk about peace constantly in terms of their own actions, about the nature of their community. But then that goes to some quite sharp questions, such as the rejection of military service and rejection of serving on the judiciary.
Because you might put people to death and things like that.
Because if you serve in the Roman world, if you serve on the judiciary, if you're a judge, then you will torture people and you will execute people. Mm. That's the job description, essentially. Mm. There's Christian orders out there, which are basically the standards of conduct, essentially, and what you'd have to sign up to if you wanted to become baptized, that says if you're in the position of being a judge, so you're obviously a higher class person who converts to Christianity, then if you want to join us, if you want to get baptized, if you want to receive the Eucharist, you're going to have to give up your role as a judge.
Mm.
So that's...
Imagine if that was the case today. Like it might not be that job, but it might be, you know.
Well, you could fill in the blanks, yeah. Couldn't you? Imagine all sorts of jobs where. So the idea that this required a major shift in your life was huge. And so baptism was the sort of crystallization of that shift. You couldn't get there until you had committed to that shift and that you were well on your way to making it. So it's baptism in early Christianity is described as a long process of re-socialization into an alternative community. It's about learning an entirely new way of living and an entirely different system of ethics and values.
And we sort of suggested that Constantine understood that to some degree because he put that off. He realized that would bring him into tension with some of this.
Exactly. And Kreider makes a lot of that fact. So he points out, the extent and the content and the quality of the Constantinian shift, he says, by the end of the 4th century, so after Constantine and by the time you get to Theodosius, for example, what baptism has become in the Roman Empire, it's now where before it was primarily believers' baptism, that's baptism of adults, by now it's become primarily infant baptism. It's become where it had been this really ritually rich process that took 1 to 3 years and involved all sorts of stages and things and symbolism and so on. By now, it's a very ritually tepid and very quick rite. Mm. And it's instead of a form of re-socialization, it's a form of socialization. So rather than signifying belonging to an alternative society, it signifies belonging to society itself.
Mm.
And so he's saying that's a huge shift in what it means to be a Christian and then who the church is.
And so that's kind of why he says Christianity became more Roman than Romania became Christian.
Yeah, that's right. So he talks much about once the Roman aristocracy comes into Christianity, which takes a bit of time, what happens is the aristocratization of Christianity. So whereas once upon Christianity had been a profoundly, at least in its language and its ceremony and the way they talked about church, a profoundly egalitarian faith, that changes profoundly.
Mm.
Once social class is brought back into the picture and affirmed. So he makes a lot of the fact, as you mentioned, that Constantine delayed his baptism, and he basically thinks he avoided the ethical change that was demanded of conversion. And so he wanted to be a Christian and an emperor without deconstructing his old world, without deconstructing his old life or his old values, which, I mean, immediately you should be hearing some of the language of Paul's letters, for example, in Ephesians or Colossians about, putting on Christ is putting on a new life, putting off your old life. You can no longer live as the Gentiles live. So he's arguing, well, with Constantine, all that stops.
Mm. I guess I'd want to problematize a little bit, like, if you've got this alternative community living within the wider mainstream community of the Roman state, one, again, like with Yoda, if more and more Christians are popping up, how long till the alternative society actually is either a parallel or quite major strand of society? And if that's the case, then re-socialization and socialization become a bit trickier to tease apart. But also, if you've got that community of peace living within the Roman world, to what extent are the Christians kind of just getting the Romans to do the dirty work for them? Of like, you know, if the Persians invade or the Goths invade, are they just as happy to live under their rule? Because they're pacifist and they're already dispossessed and that's fine? Or are they actually glad that other people are soldiers even though they're not soldiers?
Well, exactly. So that final question particularly is a good example of the sticky questions that become posed to Christianity. The more, even if it didn't become the religion of power, the more successful it becomes, the more that people adhere to it, the more those sorts of questions are going to be posed to it by those outside, but even by those within it.
Mm.
That very question remains a question for us now about our relationship to violence.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to answer for Alan Crider in that regard. So what I would say is, for Alan Crider, he's a lot more sophisticated in his thought than Yoda is. Yoda's pretty black and white, whereas Crider is much more nuanced, and he has a lot more good to say about Christendom, for example. Yoda is black and white. There's not much good that came out of Christendom. Mm. Crider's not like that. But I don't really know how in response to that, other than maybe to say these are all hypotheticals and what we can only deal with is what is and what's happened and what we should do now.
Yeah, that kind of faithfulness in your situation.
Yeah, looks, that's as best. I think that's maybe what he would say, but I'm probably not doing him justice.
Well, it's probably a pretty decent answer. Our fifth scholar is Peter Brown. He's a bit more, I don't know, he takes a different angle on these questions than the people we've just been talking about. What can you tell us about Peter Brown?
Peter, he doesn't really fit into the columns, the for and against columns. He's much more complex than that. So, whereas Peter Brown is a historian of late antiquity and one of the big names as a historian in this area, so he knows his stuff, and he's generally worshipped as too strong by historians of late. But, you know, he's up there, and the, yeah, you know, his work has to be engaged with. So here I'm responding to a book that I read. It's been around for a while, but I only read it late last year, called Through the Eye of a Needle, Wealth, The Fall of Rome and the Making of Christianity in the West, 350 to 550 AD.
It's a bit of a doorstopper book, isn't it?
It's a huge book for covering that subject. And so really what he's really interested to do in that book is chart the changing attitudes to wealth during the 4th and 5th centuries in the Roman Empire, and just at the close of as the Roman Empire collapses as well. And really, you know, the sort of core question he's dealing with is that in the New Testament, Jesus is recounted as saying it's harder for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And so the question is, well, how are the super rich of Rome, and there were some super rich people, to understand a text like this when they become Christians? And he's really he acknowledges it for the first whole few centuries, Christians thought were being taught how to be humble and suspicious of riches, and now by the end of this time, some are actively seeking wealth. So how does all this happen? So a few things to point out. One, he wants to argue that actually it's not the conversion of Constantine in 312 that really makes the big difference, but it's rather the entry of the wealthy and the super wealthy into the church, which begins to happen after the 370s and 380s AD. And he argues that that was the turning point that enabled people to begin to think of something called a Christian society. Up until then, it was sort of unthinkable. You could have Christians and you could have a church, but particularly because Roman society is a very class structured society, it's ruled by the aristocrats. So until they come into this thing, you can't think of it anything like a Christian society. He's pretty unhappy with the sort of conventional narrative of the Constantinian shift, much like Yoda's, I guess, where basically what happens is that once Christians come to power, they basically fail to challenge the rich and get quite happy to get rich themselves. And Christianity very quickly moves to a compromise with the world, which provided the foundation for its later corruption in medieval Christianity. He thinks there's a lot more going on than that. And he charts it in his book. For one, he says the process of how Christians thought about and talked about wealth was much more contested over a few hundred years. So there's a lot of people thinking very hard about that question and saying very strong things. And it's a lot of different things going on. And he thinks also there's much more merit to what he calls the imaginative new channels by which Christians began to think about wealth. So rather than just something that had to be renounced, that's something that if you had it, you had to think about how you used it. And he sees that as a source of the birth of social institutions that we value today, particularly social institutions that contribute to the common good, and especially towards the poor. And he sees that as a pretty significant shift in Christianity. It sounds like I'm arguing a pro case for it, because which is not true, because he's arguing, he basically paints a picture of all the different changes that happened, and some of them were in one direction, some were in another direction. So he's really writing a history of that. But I think that's his sort of underlying where he's going, is saying ultimately there were some good things that came out of this.
Yeah. And like any sort of, you know, respectable, well-researched, nuanced position, it kind of has that ring of like, oh, well, of course that's the right thing. And it sort of seems like some sort of compromise was inevitable there. And especially if it was a more drawn out or nuanced compromise than just like a line in the sand and then Christianity failed or fell, in Yoda's words. But I do wonder, like, if that's the case, could that situation of like interesting conversations, imaginative, creative work, people being critical while still being given a voice, could that have persisted long term? And the thing I was thinking about as we were going through this together was like John Chrysostom, he's Archbishop of Constantinople, you know, the former city in the empire. And he's criticizing the rich so much that they exile him.
Yes.
And it's
yes,
like they appointed him Archbishop. They knew what he stood for. Someone appointed him Archbishop. But yes. Then at the same time, he continues to be critical. He's like an insider critical voice there. And then the rich get rid of him. It seems like that kind of ongoing tension is a little bit unstable, but I wonder if it was possible to continue that longer than it did, or, you know, find some ongoing way to remain like that.
Well, I guess he's not making this case, but in a way, we've talked previously in some episodes, I forget which ones, about medieval Christianity and some of R.H. Tawney's arguments about that, for example. And Tawney would argue that, in a way, they did continue to argue about it. And they did, just as O'Donnell is arguing, they continued to wrestle with the question of power and political authority. They also continued to wrestle with economic questions and struggle with them and define. You know, we have this Christian text we call Scripture, and it says stuff like this. So how do we think about that in our world? And and that produces a whole range of Christian economic thinking.
Whether it's like the monks and the nuns on the outskirts, the sort of desert fathers and mothers being that outsider critical voice, or the people who are actually appointed to bishoprics, who weren't just pawns of their patrons and actually had rough stuff to say from within.
And so there were a bunch of... there's a lot of nuance and complexity to his book, and I don't think I even have my head around his book because it was so big, and I've read another book since then that sort of crowded things out. But, it's an incredibly rich book. It was a very enjoyable read. He does one of the things he points out, which is fascinating. He says, you know, when the super rich that we're talking about, the big Roman aristocrats came into Christianity late in the 4th century, they were so confronted by these questions around renunciation of wealth that a number of them did perform that pretty stunning renunciations of wealth. Like, and we're talking, you know, these aristocrats are basically multinational corporations, right? Mm. And where they basically give up their wealth and in spectacular form. And, there is a question mark about whether they were actually playing a new status game, you know, with the giving up of wealth. Sure. And whether that was – so there was a mixed dynamic to that. There was, you know, they're giving up the wealth, but they're also in a different way getting a lot of kudos for it. But also a lot of kickback, because that had all sorts of unanticipated effects on other people. So when they decided they wanted to sell all their lands, for example, and give the money away, they actually had some of them revolts of their tenant farmers who were suddenly facing having their land sold under them to someone else and a whole new set of conditions. And so they're being confronted right there and then with sticky questions, you know, like you posed before. This is the reality now of the world that you live in. If you're going to make some choices, it's not a black and white world. These choices have, present some sticky problems for you.
Mm. Do I continue to be the best multinational corporation I can be now that I'm a Christian and not mess up these tenant farmers' lives? Or do I sell on that land and give it all away and risk those tenant farmers having a much worse overlord?
Yeah, so maybe I'm simplifying things too much, but they're some of the sorts of things that I wrestled with, and different people came up with different answers. But the reality is, and he acknowledged, by the end of the period, wealth has been accepted into Christianity. You couldn't be wealthy and be Christian, which was much harder before, but it's now thought about in new ways. So wealth is to be used in certain ways, and particularly to bring in this relation between the wealthy and the poor, which had not existed in the Roman Empire.
Mm.
The poor were not thought about by the wealthy. And so they're now forced to relate their wealth both to the church and to the poor. And also the other things that happens is how they use their wealth becomes increasingly staked to their salvation or not.
Mm.
So that has some positive effects in making how serious people thought about it, but it has the negative effects of leading to essentially the worst parts of the Middle Ages, where people are effectively seeking to buy their salvation.
Mm-hmm. We've got to move on. Our final scholar is Peter Heather. He's the only non-Christian in the group, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And he writes this much more political history of late antiquity rather than Peter Brown offering like a kind of cultural religious study.
Yeah. So Peter Heather, as you said, he's not a Christian. So where the so the previous first four are all making arguments as Christians. Peter Brown is making an argument. He's got, I'm not really sure the nature of his faith, but he's got some sort of affinity with Christianity. But he's arguing as a historian. Peter Heather is a historian who is not a Christian, and he makes that clear. And he's so approaching these, and he's really in a lot of ways not reacting, reacting to Peter Brown a little bit. So I said Peter Brown sort of is one of these huge looming figures in the history of late antiquity. So Peter Heather's one of the up and coming new generation who want to challenge that,
Of course,
and present a different view. And he says in his book that he's so the book I'm referring is quite a new book called Christendom, The Triumph of a Religion, AD 300 to 1300, and it, say in Peter Lightheart's language, the triumph of religion, that would have been a, you know, a positive sounding thing. It is definitely not for Peter Heather. although he says in his introduction he's sympathetic to some aspects of Christianity, I think having read his book, in reality, he's not really. He's out of a 700-page book, he hardly has any positive observation to make, and almost every page is filled with some sort of a comment that casts a negative light on Christianity. That said, it is an important work of history, and he's doing real history, and it's and I found a lot compelling about the arguments he makes. So but I'm also a little bit suspicious of him too, for those reasons, and it's too early. The book's too new for there to be really critiques have been released yet. But so where Peter Brown offers a cultural and religious history of Christianity, he's looking at what's happening, you know, in these basically uncharted waters of what people think and how they act and behave. Heather focuses much more on the political aspects of the late Roman Empire and post-Roman Empire and then Christendom, early Europe. And where Peter Brown talks about cultural shifts and religious transformations, Peter Heather is really talking about emperors, armies, territorial expansion, those sorts of things, you know, violence often. So he, in a way, I don't think he's got read or got any interest in Alan Crider. But in a lot of ways, the arguments he makes supports Alan Crider's reading of what happened. He sees us much more of the Romanization of Christianity rather than the other way around, particularly in the 4th and 5th centuries. He sees that what was becoming, and even more than Crider, he says that actually, so he pushes this hard. He basically says the church virtually became an arm of the Roman state. And I haven't read anyone who's put it that boldly. So he says that the conversion of the Roman elites in the 4th century late 4th century was largely a product of the incentives to participate in the structures of the Roman state. So that is, it was caused by not by mission and conversion, but rather by the attractive carrots that being part of the Roman elite offered. And so he writes, quote, "Elite conversion was powered by the perception that declaring yourself a Christian offered an advantage in the struggle to maximize your position where patronage and connection mattered." That pretty pithily sums up. And so he says, of course, there were you know, there were sincere conversions along the way, but mostly that's what's going on. It's about people just getting advantage under the new regime.
Yeah, so there's very much compromised position. Christian church basically submits to Rome.
You get all these people coming into it who really are not that interested in Christianity, but they're interested in belonging to this new power structure, essentially.
Yeah.
And so he agrees essentially with Alan Crider's arguments about what happened to baptism, how that the change that underwent between the 3rd and the 4th century, and that made a big thing. And yeah, as I said, he says he really pushes hard this idea that effectively once from Constantine on, and he makes some arguments around how the Council of Nicaea, which we mentioned earlier, was set up by Constantine and almost arranged, the outcomes were arranged by how he wanted. And he pretty much argues that all the ecumenical councils were like that, that the emperors treated them like that. That will be an interesting one to see how other historians react to that, because I'm not competent to comment on that at all.
Yeah, I've definitely heard multiple perspectives.
Yeah, so he, this is a quote of his: whatever the likes of Augustine, so the great 5th century theologian Augustine, whatever the likes of Augustine wanted to believe, the emperor was to all intents and purposes the practical functioning head of the Christian church. So that's a pretty strong statement.
That's like the king or queen in England in the Church of England.
And basically his argument is that without the role of the imperial state, the victory of Christianity is inconceivable. He says a lot more, so I'll leave his summary there, but he goes on right through to thinking about the conversion of the Gothic kings, the Germanic kings, and then the Carolingian Empire, so Charlemagne in the 9th century, and what that looked like, and takes it right up until the institution of what we recognize as the all-powerful papacy in Europe in the 11th and 12th century.
Yeah, but he thinks it all begins in that 4th century Roman Empire context.
Yeah, and that shapes its character and its relationship to violence and coercion and those sorts of things.
Yeah, it does make me wonder if there were no carrots and no sticks, if it was like, if that's even possible, but if there was as minimal incentive or disincentive for the aristocracy or anyone else to become a Christian, and then like people become Christians case by case basis. Some of them might be aristocrats. They might try and be faithful in that context and attempt to be so. I wonder if that's like the best you could really hope for, if that's the case of greatest integrity for the church. I don't know.
Yeah, look, sure. I mean, again, we're back into historical hypotheticals, and in the end, all we can deal with is what did happen and where we are now because of it, which is, I guess, where we're going to go, you know, in the next episode. So we're getting on, so I guess we should begin to wrap up. So I'm just trying to think of a way we could summarize this, Jacob.
Well, I think in some ways the summary is it's very difficult to summarize. It's hard to have a perspective that draws in all the different critiques and acknowledgments of the good, understanding the bad, and sort of saying, yes, this happened, and then that meant this has happened, but what are you going to do about it? What do you think should be different? It's very complicated. And, I mean, as you're saying each of these perspectives, I find myself agreeing with different parts of them as we go along. I don't think any of them are absurd or ridiculous, but it's hard to have a whole overall view.
I think they each have something to say. They each are right in some perspective, and none of them really nails it, you know, to say this is the best person who nails it all. That's the way I feel, and there's bits, large parts of that question, and I guess this might come out in a next podcast, which I'm still unsure about.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe agnostic about.
I think I really don't know about a lot of this stuff, especially as it relates to our context, but we're going to give it a go in the next episode. And we'd love to hear feedback as well. If you guys have things to add to the conversation, send us a message. Your email's available online. We hope you liked this episode. We hope it was very much food for thought to chew on. If you know someone, if you've got back and forth about the place of the Christian church in society and in politics, and you find yourself always trying to articulate different perspectives of someone you're talking to, send it along to them. Or if you know someone who maybe has never thought about this stuff before, but might like to, might benefit from it, send it along to them. And please review us on iTunes if you like the podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts, whatever platform, it doesn't matter. And we've written a lot about wealth and Christianity in our quarterly Manor Matters. If you want more of that, you can check out the website of Manorgum, manorgum.org.au. You can subscribe to Manor Matters for free there. It comes in post or online. And we haven't written so much about the violence question, but it'd be interesting to open that up a little bit more. But there's definitely some good thinking from Jonathan and various other people who are theologically inclined, or maybe they're in various financial positions and Christians and they're thinking about these things. So there's some really good articles there to chew on. Manor Gum is funded entirely by donations. If you like what we do, please head to that same website and sign up to donate. Thank you, everyone.
For share you some give. Of your wealth.
Yeah, that's right. Give it to us. That's what you can do. And we think it's fitting. We couldn't come up with a final quote to end on this episode, but maybe that's appropriate that no one gets the final word because it is such a complicated discussion. But I've really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks for doing all that reading for us.
It was fun.
We'll catch you guys on the next one.
Thanks, Jacob.